This is a Rooster Teeth production.
Harry, what is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
This is The Stuff Dreams Are Made Of, the prop collecting podcast.
That's right. Whether you're a newer collector or a grizzled veteran of the prop wars, this is the podcast for you. I keep wanting to say propcast. I am, maybe that's a new term we can sort of market. I'm David Mandel, comedy writer, director, and collector.
And I'm Ryan Condal, screenwriter and collector. I have not yet descended into terrible puns, but we're on our way because we're working on it. So, Dave, we like to start each show by talking about what's new in props. And this week, there is a lot of stuff that's new.
Yeah, I think that is an honest-to-God understatement. This is probably, since we started recording, the biggest what's new we've had so far, because there was just this big auction here in Los Angeles held by the Prop Store, which is a prop auction. And we both added pretty significant pieces, like, you know, in that kind of like, if this is my only piece this year into next year, I'm a happy guy, like that level of acquisition. We both did that, I feel like.
Yeah.
Yours was particularly special because yours is sort of a very long time coming. I think also an understatement, dare I say.
Yes. This has been haunting me for a long time. So I bought and won at auction a Stormtrooper helmet from A New Hope from the
first movie. And a really nice one. A really, really nice one. Really
great. Yeah, I'm really excited about it. It's great. It's mostly complete original paint job, which is a big deal with these because the paint did not last on these guys. But it's a re-addition to my collection versus a brand new edition. And I about 10 years ago, I had bought a Return of the Jedi Stormtrooper helmet, and I loved it. And of course, you know, on this podcast, we talk a lot about Star Wars. Dave and I both love Star Wars. It was a major addition for me at the time, and I really did love it. But as things do in the collecting world, something else comes along, and it was just at a time where I needed to move something in order to make that happen. So
but
it would come along.
You prioritized, and that's not a bad thing. I mean, you got a one-of-a-kinder. That's what you were going for at the time.
Yes, and as I always said, like, I didn't sell it and buy a Harley. I sold it and bought what I thought was a better, rarer piece that was going to be harder to find. And I think at the time, you know, Dave has joked before, as the owner of many Stormtrooper helmets, has joked before that they were everywhere. And if you hang out in our circles, you can kind of get lulled into the sense that Stormtrooper helmets are everywhere because, you know, we could rattle off a laundry list of collectors right now that we know that have Stormtrooper helmets, but they actually still are very rare.
Yeah, things. It's a funny thing, which is to say they are incredibly rare, and yet in the 20 people we know, 15 of them have a Stormtrooper helmet. So it's a very common rare item among hardcore Star Wars prop collectors. There's no other way of explaining it. As stupid as that sounds, that's what it is.
That is the perfect way to put
it. And you have had opportunities. I mean, they have shown up over the years, but it never quite, the stars never quite lined up.
Yeah, wrong time, wrong place. And I started to feel like I was cursed. And, you know, my wife and I have had this running joke that, you know, she's very supportive of this. She you know, goes along with it and says, yes, do whatever makes you happy. And the only time she actually protested something was not me buying something. It was me selling something. It was selling that helmet. And she just said, I think you're making a huge mistake. I think we need to figure out a different way to do this. And I said, oh, no, you don't know what you're talking about. And for 9 years, she's been able to gloat over me the fact that she was totally right about Star Wars collecting, which is something she would never think that she would lay claim to in our relationship.
And I should point out that she, like me, your wife has two Stormtrooper helmets in her collection.
Well, correct, because everybody, I don't keep people in my social circle unless they own Stormtrooper helmets, multiple Stormtrooper helmets. So
more Stormtrooper helmets than you.
than
that's
me.
That's really the key.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes. I like feeling bad about myself. So I won this thing. It was really great. I knew it was coming for about 8 months, so I was able to prepare and wait and sort of, you know, drive myself crazy and think that I wasn't going to get it and all that. But it was really nice. You know, the bidding came around. It was very late at night, and the piece came up, and I went in, you know, really aggressively, and actually you got it for a bit less than I was expecting to have to go to, which is always a thrill at the auction when you not only win but get a deal.
Yeah, honestly, I think you got a real bargain. I actually think the auction house was hoping it was going to go higher. I really believe that. I think you got I don't want to say a steal, because obviously we're still talking about significant amounts of money, but compared to other ones like it that have sold, I think you really played it perfectly, and it was and it worked out great. It's a great helmet, and obviously you needed one. So
yes, right time, right place. So yeah. So it was you know, not the middle of the night, but it was very late at night, late enough that my wife had already gone to bed. So I was able to run upstairs and sort of shake her awake and say, "Hey, you know, I righted the wrongs." And she said, "Please, who are you, and get out of my bedroom?"
Yeah, it's like you shook her awake and she said, "What's the matter with the children? Is everything okay? Honey, yeah. I want a stormtrooper helmet."
I don't know. I haven't seen the children in days, but we want a stormtrooper helmet. So no, it was very exciting. I'm really thrilled. And it was odd because it's sort of, even though it's a different helmet than the one I had before, it was very much the experience of like an old friend, you know, getting back. It felt like a reclaim of a loss versus a new acquisition. I don't know how else to explain it, but
no,
I'm so excited. Yeah. And it's from the first movie. So I, you know, in the end, even though it was, you know, sort of beating myself up for the last decade over it, I was able to upgrade, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's the 9-year upgrade plan. That's not a bad plan. Yeah.
Return of the Jedi to New Hope, which, you know, everybody always wants first movie stuff. So that was my win. Dave, what you got also got a big piece.
Yeah, I don't have quite the "I had one, I got rid of it," that kind of a thing. It's just a piece for me that
your
really
wife wasn't mocking you incessantly.
No, exactly. She mocks me for other reasons. a piece that just really jumped out at me from the moment I saw this catalog, which was basically from Raiders of the Lost Ark, the first one, Raiders, a Staff of Ra headpiece.
There's
no other way of sort of saying it is what it is, you know? And it was in the making of that movie, there were basically two versions of the Staff of Ra headpiece. There was sort of one that they all wandered around with and held. And then for those close-up shots, which we've talked about, where you really saw the detail on it, there was a more detailed version. And this was one of the first kind, so a little less detailed and a little bit of damage. It only has the jewel on one side, which will be the side I display it with, but a great story about its provenance and sort of how it traveled and sort of came up for sale. You know, I felt really good about it. And it's just, I you know, it's a movie I know we've talked a lot about. I love that movie. And it's Raiders. It's the Staff of Ra headpiece. I mean, I don't know what else to say.
Great.
Yeah,
it's great. And it came right from a crew member, right? I mean, that was the
yes, exactly.
Ultimate.
Exactly. You know, just one of those stories of a crew member, I believe, that gifted it to somebody else. And I'm not going to, and you know, again, sort of what we said about you, I think we both got lucky. Another one of these things where I was prepared for worse, as they say, and it wasn't quite as bad as I was expecting. And I dare I say again, I think maybe the auction house ever so slightly hoping for a higher number. So I think we both did pretty good. And you know, that's, you know, again, it's, I'm glad there aren't auctions every day of the week. I mean, not counting eBay, but you know, when these big auctions do come up, that is right now where these pieces are showing up. That's the easiest way of putting it. The premier pieces are showing up in these once or twice a year prop auctions. And that's become for lack of a better word, that's a real factor of collecting that perhaps didn't exist 15 years ago when I was getting into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it used to be one of the avenues, and now it kind of is unless you're a guy who's out there regularly, you know, pounding the pavement and tracking down old crew members.
Which there are still guys doing that, although a lot of those guys are then putting stuff into the auction. So the auction,
I actually just heard a story about a guy that had tracked down another guy and had gotten to the point where he was making an offer on the piece, and then the person just turned around and put it into an auction because they realized, oh, I'm actually holding something. So auctions have become very, you know, mainstream ways to, you know, to getting the stuff out to the public, which is great because it makes it available to everybody.
Yeah.
can be a little frustrating for the treasure hunters of amongst us.
Well, I think it used the real thing is it used to be the sense that whether it was a collector or a prop dealer or whatever, you know, that people would, you know, would occasionally sell things or offer you things to buy. And now it feels like if someone is going to sell, they're going to wait and hold it for auction. And again, that is about, again, the continued legitimacy of these auctions, which over the years, as even studios have been selling through auctions, famous sort of like movie and TV personalities or shows have sold their stuff. So, for example, Rick Baker had a big auction at Prop Store a couple of years ago. Kevin Smith has sold stuff. Phil Tippett, who worked on Star Wars, the stop motion guy, he's done a couple of sales. And so, again, this is how these people are kind of putting out these almost pedigree collections. And it's, you know, it's really the unfortunately the way to go. Good or bad, it's the way to go.
Yeah. But here we are. So, Dave, tell me how you approach an auction. How do you
get ready? We thought this would be sort of the fun way for this show to really talk about auctions because of our win. And it all starts, you know, really, I guess, two things. Number one, you got to look at the catalog and sort of start to see, like, is there something I want? Let's start there. So, obviously, you know, as soon as I hear that there's an auction catalog, I'm tearing through it. I'm waiting till it shows up here. I'm going through it. There's sometimes
PDFs. So you like to go through the physical catalog?
I do. I love to turn the pages and dog-ear them and really look through it.
Because, of course, they're made available online as well as PDFs.
Yes.
And there's
the beautiful thing is,
yeah.
I was just saying, is anyone can look at a catalog. There is no price of admission to look at a catalog online.
Right.
And I think even if, you know, I don't know, if you are a newbie, before you dive into an auction, start looking at catalogs. Start looking at what, you know, start just looking at them. Familiarize yourself with what they are. But for me, it's about the first time I can really go through the catalog, turn the pages, start, you know, marking things, making lists, start thinking about it, start talking about it. And at the same time, I'm also going to make sure I'm registered for the auction, dare I say.
Right.
It sounds silly, but especially with a lot of these things, especially if it's a new auction I've never bid in, you need to sign up. So, I mean, again, that sounds crazy, but I want to make sure all of my stuff is sort of taken care of, all of the little stuff, so I can now just spend all of my time obsessing about the various sort of things in the catalog. You know what I mean? Are you that different, or that's kind of where you are?
No, that's really the process that I take. I mean, you know, new catalog day is really, it only happens a couple times a year.
It's the best.
It's awesome. Sitting down, going in. Simultaneously, I think hoping to find something great, but also dreading that you're going to find something great. And, you know, because there is a sort of a quieter thrill in getting through an auction catalog and saying, you know what, I don't think I need anything here, and just sort of being able to sit back and
there's something
relax.
Very pleasing about, I'm good. And really what I try and then figure out is, you know, there's a whole bunch of different ways you can bid in these auctions. You can basically submit a bid. You can bid on computers.
So absentee bid, right? Bid in advance.
Exactly.
And then if you get, it's like eBay. Yeah.
Right.
If you get it, you get it. If you don't.
Yeah. You put a number in, you walk away. You can bid on a computer. Usually there are live bidding situations through a computer, especially now with COVID. That usually has an extra fee. And that's the other thing I'm always sort of like obsessing on is I want to know all of the fees. What are my options? Because certain ways of bidding have certain different fees. Paying with credit card as opposed to a wire transfer might have a different fee. So I want to know all of my fees going in. So it's a little bit like voting. I want to make my bidding plan. So I know that, for example, I like to phone bid. That's my preferred way of bidding.
That's the best way to do it where Vladimir Putin can't influence the bidding.
No, that's exactly it. Yeah. But especially, by the way, if I can't be there, and obviously right now with COVID, I used to, you know, we used to all go to these auctions, which was really fun because, you know, it was like a social event. There'd be a big auction. We'd all get together, maybe have lunch in the middle of the auction, go have dinner that night. And, you know, that's how I got to know so many of the collectors that I know. So that's another fun part of the old, you remember the old world where we used to go to restaurants and be in like more than two people at once, not outside wearing masks.
I've heard tale
that?
Of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, you're much younger than me. So let me tell you.
The tablets,
about, yeah. Let me tell you about 2018.
Going down to dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. So, I mean, we sort of glazed past it, but I think it's important because there are probably people listening that have never participated in an auction. But you talk about fees. What you really mean is the premiums, right? So there's a seller's premium and buyer's premium.
Yes.
And so explain.
Well,
those
I guess
to
basically it's
listeners.
Like let's say we're bidding 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. I win the piece for $6,000. I'm not paying $6,000. There's usually a seller's premium or seller's fee, whatever you want to call it, where the auction house adds, these days it's up and over 20% to what they call the hammer price. So the hammer is when the auction guy goes, sold $6,000, and then the auction house adds another percentage on top of it, a fee, and they're also charging the seller. So they're kind of like a bookie. They're the middle guy. They make it on both ends. So I'm paying that fee on top of it. I want to know what that fee is. Sometimes there are, as we said, higher fees, meaning it's one seller's fee if you're bidding this way, but a higher seller's fee if you're bidding on like the computer system. So again, I want to know all of that stuff. And then again, credit cards, tax. I want to know everything. Am I paying import fees if I'm buying from an auction in the UK? What are my options there? So again, to me, it's just about like sort of making that plan, knowing, laying it all out and knowing it, you know, knowing what I'm going to do. So that's not what I'm worried about in those as I'm waiting for the auction to come, because that's where I really dig in and I'm starting to do, you know, everything we've ever talked about, the research, the research, the research. If I can visit, I'm going to go there and take my own pictures. If I can, if I can't visit, you know, because of COVID or whatever, I'm emailing and asking for more pictures. If there's something I want to see, can I have a close-up of the label? Can you make sure I get an inside shot of the helmet? I want to see the foam in the helmet. I want to see the scratches on the handle. Like, I'm looking to do the research. I'm checking out the story. I'm asking, what can you tell me about this crew member? If you can't tell me their name, what else can you tell me about this alleged, you know, person that's there? Oh, there's a letter. I want to look at the letter. You know, whatever it is, this is where in that sort of space between having seen these pieces I like and the actual auction day, this is where I'm working all of that stuff out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you usually have about a month to do that, because usually
yes.
The catalog gets posted.
The worst
about a month
ever. Yeah, and you just desperately salivate right. And wait. Yeah.
So day of auction. There's a, you know, we talked about, there's a bunch of different ways to bid. I think, you know, online bidding is very, you know, people, internet savvy people will be very familiar with this. You kind of go on, you track the thing, you click to bid, whatever. The two more, you know, archaic throwback methods of bidding are being either a phone bidder or a floor bidder. And floor bidding isn't going on right now because of COVID, but back in the day when it did, that means that, you know, when you see a movie or a TV show where an auction is going on, you see the people actually sitting on the floor, you know, eyeing each other back and forth and raising their paddle.
No,
on the
you
floor.
Literally That's, have a paddle.
You're there.
It seems like everything I learned about auctions, I feel like I learned in like Gilligan's Island, where they would have like auctions on the island. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
But what you think an auction is what an auction is. If you've seen one like in a bad TV show or movie, there are paddles.
If I couldn't learn it in 70s and 80s television, I don't want to know it, basically.
Yeah, it's a scene. It's fun though. And then the other version is you're doing the same thing, but you're basically on the phone with someone from the auction house who basically is holding a paddle for you and you're
yes.
talking to them basically.
But the idea is that you're live at that point. So if you're bidding on the computer, there's a detachedness from that where you can't really see and feel what's going on. If you're on the phone, the best thing is being on the floor, because then you can see all what's going on. You can see the phone bidders, so the people that are bidding, the proxy bidders that are bidding for people on the phone. You can see the other people bidding on the floor. You know whether 10 people are bidding or 2 people are bidding, whatever. When you're on the computer, it's very hard to tell what's going on. That's fine to me for a lesser piece, something, you know, something lower value that you would like to win, but you're not particularly bothered about. For me, if I've got the white heat and I need to have the piece, I need to either be on the phone or on the floor.
Yeah, I'm trying to read the situation, whether it's phone or floor, of like, how quickly is the other guy coming back? Is he stalling? Does he, you know, there's something called a cut bid that certain auction houses will allow you to do, which is, as you go higher, the bidding is supposed to be a very specific, you know, amount. It's supposed to go up
by
1,000.
The increments go up.
Yes, the increments. And you're allowed to do a cut bid, which is 50% of the amount. Although when someone does that, usually
sign of weakness.
They're either getting near their end, or maybe they think you're getting near your end. So they're trying to sort of
right.
not bid as much as they need to. And I love that kind of stuff. You know, if someone's just sitting there in an actual auction where you're there and their hand is just up and not coming down, boy, I start to think, boy, they really want it. You know what I mean? So again, these are the things you're sort of trying to read into the sort of situation. And again, half the time I'm right, half the time I'm wrong, but that's, you know, half the fun of it are sort of these strategies I sort of give myself and tell myself.
Yeah. It's a thrill and there are victory days and defeat days and, you know, and bloody days. And we'll tell some stories later, but.
And I was just going to throw in one other thing is one thing that also sort of, I don't know. And do you have a preference on this? I was actually going to ask you this because certain auction houses will put an opening bid that is more or less basically, usually a piece will have a reserve, and what the reserve is basically the number that they want to sell the piece for. They're not going to sell it for less. And certain auction houses will just start the bidding basically right below the reserve. So basically they'll go, I'm going to pick Stormtrooper helmet just to pick Stormtrooper helmet. Here's a Stormtrooper helmet. Opening bid is $100,000. And what you know there right then and there is if you bid $100,000 and nobody else bids, you win, you get it. As opposed to here's a Stormtrooper helmet. We're going to start the bidding at $1,000. Now, even though they're letting you bid $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, they may have a reserve that is $100,000. And until it gets there, it doesn't sell. And I sometimes like the just, if I bid, that's the number. But I sometimes miss the action of when something sort of starts lower and you kind of get that bidding frenzy a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and it goes crazy. But again, pluses and minuses to both. Do you have a preference?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I like the reasonable estimates. You know, they call it the estimate because in the auction catalog, most of the prop catalogs will have, you know, an item in it. It will say, you know, Batman cowl, you know, $10,000 to $15,000. That means that. Usually means that the reserve on the item is $10,000 and they think that it could go as high as 15, but a lot of times that's just to get the bidding going. They actually think that's a $30,000 piece and they just want to get the action in. I feel like it's usually better for them to get the action in because once people start going, there's a competitiveness, there's a fever that takes over.
You know what? I agree with that. I didn't think about that, but I'm going to completely agree with that. That like if there's a little bit of bidding action, it plays to the favor, I think, of the auction house because people get stupid. There is that auction fever. Whereas when you go into something and just go, hey, it's $100,000. Hey, it's $50,000. Again,
somebody's trying to take that for the first bid. They're just hoping that there's
and
one
it's
bid.
Hard yeah. to, if someone bids 100, it's hard to just come out of the gate and be the second bidder at $110,000. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then be ready to also bid again after that. Like he bids you up and then you bid him up and then it's like,
you need
it's
a little
hard
whining and dining. Like if it starts at say 50,000 and then slowly works its way to 100,000, then all of a sudden you're kind of like, yeah, this feels good, right? Come on, this is nice and gentle.
So auctions can be very daunting if you've never been part of one, but we are here to tell you that 100% they are not. To discuss that with you, we have a very special guest, and he can also help put your mind at ease. He's the owner and founder of Profiles in History out of Calabasas, California, and this is one of the premier prop auction houses, and they also do auctions for historical documents and other collectibles, which he'll tell you about. Please, everybody, welcome Joe Maddalena.
Hey, Joe, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Real good. Thanks for doing this. We talk about the collecting gene, being born with the collecting gene. And so I think the first thing that people want to know about anyone that's involved in an auction house, are you a collector yourself? Do you have it? Did you collect as a kid? Where does it start for you?
Yeah, it's in my DNA. My parents were antique dealers. So you can imagine I grew up on the East Coast like you. So I'm 6, 7, 8 years old and they're taking me to antique shows and they're dealing in like rugs and, you know, furniture and, you know, decorative arts. And like, I'm bored out of my mind. So I collected just like, I mean, baseball cards, coins, stamps, postcards. I mean, I just bought it all. I mean, because it was all so cheap, like piles and piles and piles. And it just became an obsession of like, I had to have it. I would dream about it. One time when I was a kid, I got so sick and the doctor could not figure out what was wrong with me. And they finally came over to the house like this, like to do an environmental test. And they walked in my bedroom and my entire bedroom was comic books wall to wall. And the doctor came mom and said, "You wonder why he's sick? He's breathing that stuff. Get him out of his bedroom."
That's great. Literally almost killed by your collection. That's a new one for the stuff dreams are made of.
I know. We got to get the hoarder versus collector. In that world, was it comic books that was first among equals? Did they kind of rise to the top or was it, it really was everything?
I would say, you know, it was a combination of comic books and baseball cards. I was like really obsessed with both. I was collecting both equally. I mean, at one time I probably had a million comic books. I mean, I made a lot of comic books. I mean, I was, so what I would do is, you know, I'm older than you guys. I would go through the back of the comic books, and then back there'd be like these little things that they'd ask Stan a question. And I would look up, like the guy would be like, hey, Ken Reckrutt in, you know, Pawtucket, Rhode Island. I'd look in the phone book. I'd call him up and say, hey, you got a collection? He'd be like, sure. I remember driving over to this guy's house, and he was like, he was a prison guard or something. And he's like, I need a new Glock. I'm like, okay, well, I'm here to help you. So, I mean, I bought like, you know, like a basement full of comic books for $250 so this guy could go buy a gun.
Doing your part for Law and Order. That's great. And was it through your parents, because they were, for lack of a better word, as you said, dealers, when did you make the turn from sort of not just collecting, but into the idea of selling as well?
When I was 17, I moved to California and I went to Pepperdine. And I remember getting out of college, and I was an intern for Vin Scully. And I remember making a whopping $1,200 a month. And I was like wondering like how I'm going to survive here. Like, so I started to go into Hollywood, and there were all these amazing shops. I mean, just the best. You could go in and you could buy like a shooting script of the Maltese Falcon for $25. I mean, they had everything. So this is pre-internet, pre-eBay. So I would basically get a bunch of quarters, get on a payphone, call dealers up on the East Coast. And suddenly I realized there was like a 30% price difference between the West Coast and the East Coast. And I could make 30% basically by buying the stuff and shipping it back east, because it all had come out west. So that's how I got started. I mean, literally, it was out of sheer desperation to not, you know, eat Spam every night because I was starving. And, you know, so it's like, that's how it started.
And what made the move to auctions? I mean, were your parents involved as auctioneers, or was that something that was unique to you?
You know, I had attended like auctions my whole life. So, we grew up in that world. So if my parents would buy an estate, they would sell the highlights, the very best pieces. If they didn't have private collectors, everything went to auction. So there would be like the best stuff would go to Sotheby's and Christie's in New York. And then there'd be secondary auctions all throughout New England. So, I mean, there was an auction in where I grew up 7 nights a week. I mean, like there was like, that's what they did every single night. They were either buying at auction or selling at auction. So I kind of understood the auction world from a really different viewpoint. So I remember I consigned something to auction in New York, one of the big houses, and I got killed. Something I'd paid $10,000 for, I got two. And I was like, whoa, this is not good. So I'm like, you know something? I'm going to start my own auction business. So it was 1995. So the first 2 or 3 years, I mean, my auctions lost money every single time. My bookkeeper would come in, my accountant would come in, like, you're losing hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm like, I know, but I just feel like this is going to work one of these days.
Did the Planet Hollywood thing, did that help sort of, I guess, legitimize it, that people were sort of seeing stuff, you know, on display? Do you think that had a real effect on things?
A huge effect, Dave. You know what it did? It popularized it. Planet Hollywood got people like John Azarian would go into these restaurants. He'd be like, I want something. I want a piece of this. So I give them the ultimate credit, because they really did show the world that what this stuff was. They were the pioneers of really making this a understood collectible.
And is that where it turned for you, Joe? Is that where the auction started becoming profitable for you? Was it tied into Planet Hollywood? Or was it a particular event auction piece that you got? What was it?
I can tell you the exact moment my life changed. I was sitting in my office and my assistant came in and she said, there's a guy named Herb Solo on the phone. Sounds kind of crazy. He said he created Star Trek. He won't talk to anybody but you. I'm like, Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek. I don't want to talk to him. So this guy was really persistent. So finally I got on the phone with him and he, of course, lectured me. I created Star Trek. I said, Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek. That's not true. I was the head of NBC television. I worked for Desilu. I bought Star Trek. I cooked. That's different than you created it. Okay. So Herb and I quickly became friends. Herb was the executive in charge of production. Without him, there would not have been a Star Trek. Okay. So all of a sudden, you know, Herb was living in Malibu and he needed to sell stuff. And he really didn't have anything good. So it was like, I never forget the day. He's like, I want to introduce you to my friend, Matt Jeffries. I'm like, wow, Matt Jeffries, that'd be cool. So I remember going to Matt Jeffries' house and I walked in and there's like everything. He saved everything from the original series. My mind exploded. He had like unbelievable amounts of stuff. And Matt's like, yeah, I want to sell it all. So I remember it was 1999, 2000. And I had my first auction. It was at the Galaxy Theater inside the old Hollywood Museum on Hollywood Boulevard. It doesn't exist anymore. And I had this Star Trek auction, and it grossed $1 million. I could not believe it. It was like, oh my God, I finally made it. And you know, it was like, that was the turning point. That moment with Herb Solo, I owe a lot to him because he got me into that world, and that opened every door imaginable.
How does it start for you when you're putting together a prop auction? How does it start for you? Like, where do you start?
So we have two simultaneous plans of attack. We are always looking for anchor pieces, which are, you know, high profile, PR worthy, cool things. And then we're also looking for a wide genre, because I'm probably the only auction house that covers the beginning of film till present day. Everybody else kind of specializes where I cover the entire gamut. So for me, it's like, it has to be that or I won't do an auction, you know? So it's like, so we kind of accumulate. And once I feel like I've gotten enough material that crosses all genres, then I put together an auction. But I don't do it until I feel like I've got that core mass. So it's a different, like I might only do one big auction a year now. I might have a lot of small ones in different fields. I might do 10 auctions a year. But one for Hollywood, you know, unless I get a special collection, it's probably one big one.
And do you still see, I mean, we've talked a little bit about, Ryan and I have talked about the fact that the earlier films, you know, the gold, the costumes and all of that, that sort of seems a little bit, I don't want to get into the money of it all, but that was sort of where the collecting sort of started, but perhaps is not as popular these days. But you still like to sort of stock an auction with that stuff. You still have faith in it.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, do we have faith in film? I mean, to me, film has influenced the entire world. I mean, you can go anywhere on this planet and mention Harry Potter, or you can mention Hasta La Vista, Baby, and they know it's a Terminator. And it's like, I tell people it's an international currency. A Mickey Mantle baseball card is an American phenomenon. You know, it's not, no, you can Mickey Mantle, they think it's, you know, a Disney product if you go overseas. I mean, it's not, you know, so it's like, so that's the thing about film. I mean, it influences so much of our lives. You know better than anybody, both of you guys working in the industry, the power it has of, you know, what we aspire to look like, dress, wear, who our heroes are.
For somebody new that sort of, let's just go right to the beginning, somebody who's never bid in an auction on anything, do you have advice? Or what do you say to the first time bidder, the guy that like is kind of going, can I trust this? What is this? What do I do? What do you say to that person when they call up or they walk into your place the first time?
Never buy this stuff as an investment. Ever, ever, never. Buy it because you love it. Buy it because it makes you happy. Buy it because it brings you joy. So that's rule number one. No investments. If you want to invest, this is don't buy collectibles. Okay. So like that's start with that. The second thing I tell people is like, look, I don't care how much you have to spend. If you have $100, $1,000, or $1 million, it's better to buy a good thing or a few good things than a bunch of stuff. Because what I see the first impulse of the new collector is they come in and they buy like all this stuff because they can't control themselves. Then all of a sudden, a year later, they're like, oh, now I want something good.
That is it's a lesson I hadn't really thought about, but I do think it's an incredibly good one. And I think maybe all collectors have to learn that lesson, which is, and again, not to make it about the money, but if you just to think about it in simple mathematics, you just buy the first 10 $100 pieces that come your way, and now you have a pile of stuff, and then one day the $1,000 piece that really means something to you comes along. I think that's a great lesson to learn, which is just not to willy-nilly just start acquiring.
I talk about this all the time. Yeah, it's just like, I call it, you know, nickel and diming yourself out of your next dream piece, and it's like, it's patience, really is what it requires is patience.
And you have to learn. The last component I tell people is, I mean, sit it out for 6 months. Like, look at a bunch of different auctions, figure out like kind of what's out there and ask questions. I mean, it's like, I've sold more of this stuff than anybody. So if you can come in and say to me, gee, I'm interested in a Terminator jacket from T2 or T1. Okay. I can say to you, okay, I've sold 20 of them. All right. So here's the deal with them. There are clean ones and there are distressed ones and there are, you know, ones that fold with bullet holes with, you know, squibs in them. And there are all these different versions of these costumes. Okay. And, you know, I can go through a process with somebody and sit them down and say, okay, they can go for 15,000. They can go for 100,000, depending on how complete it is or what it is. And it's like, it's more of that education. Because we've had so much stuff where I can sit down and somebody says, is this rare? And I can say, no, I've had 30 of them. With people, it's just like being patient, learning, and just like buy the best you can afford and don't be influenced by other people. If you really love Hot Tub Time Machine, collect Hot Tub Time Machine and have fun. It's just about having fun. This isn't about somebody saying, yeah, oh, that's a stupid movie.
You gotta buy
what you love.
Love a movie, whatever the movie is, the worst movie in the world. If you love it, you love it and have the great, cool prop from it. That's your collection, whoever you are out there. That's a wonderful thing to be able to express your love of that film. With all the auctions you've done, is there a piece that kind of you sold through auction that you still think about like, God damn, I wish I owned it. Do you know what I mean? Like that you put into somebody else's collection that to this day you kind of wish you could have bought.
I would say, you know, either the Ruby Slippers or Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I'm fortunate in my life. I've sold two pairs and hopefully we'll sell a third one day. And it's just like, I never thought in my career I'd handle a pair of Ruby Slippers. I remember one day like laying there being like, well, you know what? I'll never sell a pair of Ruby Slippers. I just have to accept that in my career, that's not going to be something I'll ever do. And oh my God, I had Debbie's and then I had, you know, the Samuels pair that DiCaprio now bought for the Academy. And that was kind of the apex of my goal in life was to like, I always wanted to handle a pair of Ruby Slippers. But again, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is the one that was like, oh, so tempted. I mean, it's like, cause it's like, you own Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. How cool are you? I mean, it's just like how do you top that? It's like you pull up to school with your kids and you're like, you're in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I don't care what Ferrari or Lamborghini is next to you. You're in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It's like, you can't beat that.
So Dave, we have a new sponsor today. We want to welcome to the podcast and that's HelloFresh.
Yeah, this is really exciting. Welcome aboard HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. You can save 40% by using HelloFresh versus shopping at your local grocery store. And it's more convenient too, because it shows up right at your house.
HelloFresh offers so many delicious options every week to help you break out of your recipe rut and try new things.
My kids are so sick of the four things that I know how to make okay, in particular this salmon dish that they are just ready to rebel. And we got our first box, and in the box was pork sausage spaghetti bolognese, firecracker meatballs, crispy buffalo spiced chicken. The kids just saw the pictures on the recipe and literally started cheering. That's how happy they were that I wasn't making my regular salmon again. So that alone was a great day in the Mandel household.
Well, and what I love is that HelloFresh delivers pre-portioned ingredients, so you're never overbuying, which is, as we know, a burden on the planet and your wallet. And the packaging that HelloFresh uses to ship your food is almost made of entirely of recyclable and or already recycled content.
Yeah, it goes right into the recyclables. And also, the most important thing is you can easily change your delivery days or food preferences, allergies, whatever it is, and you can skip a week whenever you need to. I got to tell you, we're going to actually make, as soon as I get off this recording, we're going to make the pork sausage spaghetti bolognese tonight. This looks so good. I mean, spaghetti bolognese and pork is always good, but there's actually zucchini hidden in the recipe, which means I'm going to force my kids to eat a vegetable and they're not going to know they're eating a vegetable because they're going to be so happy about the bolognese part. Everything is explained. I read through it once. It taught me how to decase a sausage. I am so excited and looking forward to trying this. And like I said, my kids are just happy I'm not making salmon. So really, really excited about HelloFresh tonight.
Go to HelloFresh.com/Dreams80 and use your code Dreams80 to get a total of $80 off across 5 boxes, including free shipping on your first box.
That's go to HelloFresh.com/Dreams80 and use code Dreams80 to get a total of $80 off across 5 boxes, including free shipping on your first box.
A I'll leave you with the last story. So this guy came in and he has John Travolta's jacket from Saturday Night Fever. I'm like, okay, well, how do you know it's real? And no tags, off the rack jacket. He goes, because it's mine. I'm like, what do you mean it's yours? He pulls out the photo from 1975 or whatever year it was. And there's him in the jacket with Travolta. When they were shooting the scenes with Travolta in the leather jacket, they didn't like the one he was wearing the studio provided because it was perfect. And they said to this guy who was like a second AD, give us your jacket. You're the same size. Travolta wore that jacket throughout the movie, gave it back to the guy because it was his jacket. No one knew that story. No one ever knew that, including me. I've got that jacket. But more importantly, I've got the pictures. I've got the history. I've got, you know, to me, like that's like, that is what this is all about. It's like, there it is. There could be other ones, but Travolta never wore them. This is the one.
Yeah. I mean, it's the stories are some of the best parts of this.
I think that's the perfect end. Thank you, Joe, for joining us. Much appreciated.
Yeah. Can you tell us where to find you, Joe, and where to find Profiles in History?
Yeah, you can just go to our website, profilesinhistory.com. We're in Calabasas. We're very easy to find. You can Google us, and you know all of our catalogs in the past are online. We'll have a sale either the end of October or early November, and then we'll probably have one more sale in December. We've got some great Christmas stuff. So we're gearing up because this obviously has been a very quiet year with this COVID nightmare we're all living with. So, you know, I'm hoping that this round of auctions will at least, you know, cheer people up because there'll be some fun things.
Great.
All righty. Well, thank you, Joe Maddalena. That was excellent. You know, Ryan, I realized there was one thing after we let Joe go that I did actually want to ask him about. Basically, when after Carrie Fisher passed away, very sadly, his
Princess
auction
Leia.
House yeah, did an auction of her possessions. And it was a really fascinating auction. And I guess what I was really fascinated by was there were definitely some interesting high-priced items and some autographed things and, you know, pieces with connections, obviously, to Star Wars. But what I found fascinating was on a pound-for-pound, like, sort of, like, percentage sort of price. And again, I know we never like to talk about price. The huge money makers in the Carrie Fisher auction were actually the run of the mill, just everyday items, like a $5 toaster selling for $200 because it belonged to Carrie Fisher. So basically you're talking about like 2,000 and 3,000% markup on these just very sort of ordinary like home items.
Hoping that perhaps her last piece of toast was kept.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That Princess Leia's toaster. And I find that both wonderfully ghoulish and also fascinating. But by the way, you know, again, in the grand scheme of things, you know, $200 is a nice sort of entry level price to own a little piece of Princess Leia. And if a toaster does it for you, you know, God bless you, but I am fascinated by that part of the collecting world because it's not something I ever kind of go for, I guess. I don't have a lot of toasters in my collection.
There is a big sort of estate auction thing, and I've always been fascinated by, like, look, I love Harrison Ford. I probably love him more than I care to admit to anybody, including to the audience of this podcast. You know, someday Harrison Ford will pass away. I mean, hopefully not for 50 years, but... I don't know, like,
I don't want to own
buy
his
toaster.
Yeah, I don't need his lamps.
Right.
I'm not that interested in the rug that sat in his living room. Yeah,
yes.
It's definitely an interesting
very interested in his vest and leather jacket.
Rumor has it he keeps a lot of his costumes.
Oh, very exciting.
Do you have any favorite of your own, dare I say, auction victories, non-toaster related?
I do. Sadly, I've never been on a toaster. But the movie that's really become really important to me, you know, not only as a fan of cinema and all that, but as a writer and somebody that does this stuff for a living, is Blade Runner. And Blade Runner is just one of those films. There's just not that much stuff around. There actually was at some point, but Blade Runner collectors are crazy. And they buy stuff.
There are a couple of guys in particular that have hoovered up a lot of the stuff, so that makes it that much harder.
Yes, and it goes. Yeah. And we call these black hole collections, and they just disappear, never to be seen again. In around I think 2009, Profiles in History, Joe's company, actually got their hands on the Hero Blade Runner blaster. So the the hero working, basically the functioning gun that he used throughout the entire movie, and there was only one built. So this is one of those instances where there's only one of them. They got their hands on it, came right from somebody that had worked on the film. This piece is one of the most puzzled over movie props of all time, especially in the replica world, which you'll remember I came from. So people have studied and studied and studied, and the thinking was, right until the mid 2000s, so sort of for the first 25 years since the release of the film, the thinking was that this thing was either owned by Ridley Scott, possibly Harrison Ford, or it had been lost to history. And then suddenly one day it just appeared. And it did this little tour around. It was sort of shared at a Worldcon convention, and then it went into auction. And this was very exciting for everybody, especially for me, because again, it's become my favorite film. So I was really excited. I drove out to the I was in no place to bid on this thing, which was it's certainly going to go to.
But I did, by the way, I did the same thing. And one of the things we should mention this is, and again, in a non-COVID world, auction houses are very happy to have you call up, especially if you're local to them, make an appointment and ask to see something in person. And when you're going to see the things you may want to actually bid on, there's no crime in saying, can I see the Blade Runner gun and take some pictures of myself holding it just for the heck of it?
Posing so, like Harrison Ford, like a creeper?
Exactly. Yes. Right before I kill, what's his name?
Yes, Leon. Yeah, actually, Deckard only shoots women in that movie, so the men are killed.
That's really why the movie has grown on you, but go on.
Especially in these times. So I was just really excited to go out and see this thing. I actually have a photo of myself, a younger, handsomer version of Ryan, that we'll post on the social feed, holding the hero prop right before it was auctioned off. And I went to the auction. I actually went to the floor of this auction because I wanted to see this thing go. I was so excited, and it was just something that I couldn't believe I was in the presence of it. And so I was on the floor, and the bidding just went crazy. The gun ended up hammering for over $200,000. And this was in 2009 when nothing did that.
Yeah,
that's
a more unfortunately commonplace number, dare I say.
Now, in 2020, but in 2009.
But at the time, it was definitely startling. Not
unheard of,
well, but yet not surprising because it's such an incredible piece. So yeah.
Yes, but I was on the floor, and it was actually a collector friend of ours that ended up winning it. It was really exciting because we were rooting for him. He was on the floor watching it all. It was really exciting. But there was somebody on the phone that every bid that went up, there was just the phone answered it. And it was like, who is on that phone? Who's on the line? What billionaire is into this? So it was just the two of them head to head, punching back and forth, bidding as the increments go up and up. Because as you get to higher levels of bidding, when you're up in $100,000, they're not bidding in $100 increments. They're bidding in $10,000 increments. And then at some point they go up to $20,000 increments. It gets really, you get sort of heart palpitations, even though it's not your money on the line. So I was there to see it hammered down. It won. It was great. It went to a collection that we know very well. We can go and visit it and see it. It's great. Smash to some years down the road after that, I actually got wind that one of the stunt handguns, one of the stunt Deckard blasters, was going into auction. Now, these are around, but they're still very rare. There's probably, we know of what.
Well, we talked about mine a little bit in the first show, maybe? I can't remember. We talked about it.
Yeah, yeah. And you have one that came right from the producer and all that. And they're wonderful. I mean, they're made of this high-density rubber, so they can kind of be thrown around. But it's nice. It's not like a flimsy rubber. It's solid. And what's really cool about it is that they're made with the cast amber grips on the side. The pistol grips are this cast, that clear amber that you see in the prop at all. That gives it that kind of other dimensionality that makes it feel like a little more than a typical stunt prop. And this was just, for me, I knew I was never going to own the hero. For me, this was just like the second best thing, and I had to have it. And I think actually the first bit of intel came from you, Dave, because you knew that I badly wanted this thing. And you called me one day and said, hey, I heard that one of these is coming up to auction. So it was months away. I prepared and prepared and prepared. I did all of my research to make sure it was good and real. And because these things, the Blade Runner gun might be one of the most, other than outside of Star Wars props, might be the most replicated piece on the planet. So you just have to be very careful because people have studied this thing. They know it. They know the dimensions of it. They know how to make them. So I had to go and make sure that it was real. I had the advantage of knowing Dave and seeing his, seeing his prop. I was very familiar with it. I actually went to a level that that Dave still laughs at me about. I bought a kitchen scale and I weighed his because it's made of a certain kind of rubber. And I weighed his to the gram and I took it to actually took it out to it was sold by Profiles in History. So I took the scale out to Profiles and I put theirs on the scale to see, you know, how it measured up, because figuring that they poured the stuff out of the same material, they cast it, they were making these all at once, it should be within, you know, a 5 to 10% confidence range. And it was bang on. It weighed exactly as much as yours did. So that, you know, everything else, you know, felt and smelled right. It was great.
Now,
I was super excited.
At that moment when he showed up with the scale, I do believe the auction house knew they had a bidder, hook, line, and sinker.
Yes,
they had at least one bidder.
Yes,
at that point, they were, I believe that is the opposite of a poker face.
After they had the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department escort me out the back door. But so I went, you know, I'm a big fan of floor bidding. So I got ready. I had the conversation with my wife, you know, where this is something we have to have. I think there's something that's quite unlike being, you know, being on the floor, you know, that means being present at the auction. You're in the room with the auctioneer when it happens. So you actually have a paddle in your hand. And it was very important for me because I wanted to be on the floor to see all that action going on. And I just didn't know what I was going to be up against. Because again, people are nutty about Blade Runner. And one of these things had not come up in some,
been a very long
probably
while,
10, yeah. 10 years. So I was on the floor. They were a couple of lots away. I'm sort of starting to look around. And you'll see, when you get used to these things, you'll go to the auction, you'll see there's a whole bank of phones. And what happens is they have all these staffers that work at the auction that are responsible for calling the phone bidders. And they call them a few lots out from their lot so that they're ready, they're on the phone, they're ready to bid. And I saw that, you know, we were getting to that part of the auction catalog and a bunch of phones were picked up, which is never a good sign when you're coming up on that thing that you want to win, because it means that there might be a bunch of people bidding on it. And it's sort of hard to suss out exactly, are they bidding on my lot or are they bidding on the you know, the lot after it? Because they call people, again, it's like, four, you know, sometimes 5 to 10 lots out and you'll be on the phone. If you're on the phone, you'll hear a couple of pieces auctioned off before they get to you. So I was kind of laying in wait and watching and sort of, you know, trying to get a lay of the land, like how many people am I going to be bidding against? So the bidding starts. There was a couple bids on the internet, you know, we call them absentee bids. So people that had put in bids before the auction, just hoping to kind of take the piece home if nobody else bid on it. Then they opened the bidding to the floor. And I just immediately jumped in just to put myself on the map so that anybody else was there could see that there was another bidder on the floor. There was no other bidders on the floor.
Is that your strategy always?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends. I mean, on a bigger piece, sometimes I like to lay in wait and sort of see if other people are going to come in. So I bid, and then there was an internet bidder that one of the staffers at Profiles was taking bids for. So I could see that was going on. And that's on my right. And on my left, I see one of the phone banks. Nobody's bidding on the phone. There are people on the phone, but I'm now at this point hoping that they're waiting for the next lot and not my lot. But I see one of the guys is frantically dialing and redialing the phone and flipping through his book. There was somebody that wanted to bid on this thing that they could just not get on the phone, and whatever was happening wherever in the world. So I'm kind of watching out of the corner of my eye, hoping that this—
By the way, I have been that guy, sadly. A couple of years ago, there was an auction for a small—
The small Y-wing.
Yes, the small Y-wing. And we were in the middle of Veep production, and it was just one of those things where I had arranged phone bidding, and the timing just worked out absolutely perfect, where they hit the auction just as I got on an incredibly important Veep phone call. And I knew I could see them calling me, and there was nothing I could do. I was just trapped in a prison of my own making. And again, it was okay. And it was a piece that I was probably a little mixed on anyway. Like I was not like, it was not for me a be all end all, or I probably would have covered my bases, but it was just very funny. It was just like, I got on the phone and then the other phone rang. It was just like, I could see it happening in front of me. Yeah. But the part of the story that I did like was I was then told later that they like literally stopped the auction to try and get a hold of me. But anyway.
That's being an important client. So, well, they did not stop the auction for whoever this was. So I was actually thrilled because they never got him on the phone. And so I'm up against this internet bidder. And this is where it was really good strategy to be on the floor, because I was able to basically pound this guy into submission. So they would bid, and then I would bid so fast that because when you're on the floor, you're getting instant feedback. The auctioneer can see you. They can make eye contact with you. You can see what's going on. So they can see and register your bid. With the internet, there's a it's happening at light speed, but there is a delay because the auctioneer has to report to the internet. The internet has to report back to the user, depending on their internet speed, what's going on. So by the time this guy was getting his bid in, he was already outbid. And this probably happened 10 times. And there, at some point, they just bailed out because I was bidding so fast.
Sure, but even in a live bidding situation, even if the other person had been there, I think there is an aggressive move to be said if you're looking, again, for bidding strategies of, you know, for lack of a better word, keeping your paddle up and just bidding. Again, if you're comfortable in that realm, to show that there's no hesitation on your part can make another person kind of realize, well, you know, because you're always thinking like, well, if I bid one more, am I going to get it? But if I'm bidding against somebody that just doesn't seem to be stopping, at some point, you know, you just go kind of go, ugh, there's no point.
They're standing on their chair, like, yeah, holding their paddle up, yeah, like John Cusack. Yeah. So I was, you know, I was able to win it. It was great. I was so excited because it was just, you know, I didn't think I was ever going to be able to get a Blade Runner piece of that level of significance into my collection. And so I was just excited to win. I actually had a bunch of other collectors that we know that were also there on the floor bidding on other things. So it was fun. We got to, you know, I got a bunch of handshakes and high fives back when it was safe to do that. All right, Dave, so that's my war story. What do you have?
I truly had the pleasure of basically bidding against a billionaire. This would have been around 2003, and I was actually in Prague. I was in the Czech Republic. I was making the movie Eurotrip.
Oh, yes. One of the great teen sex comedies of all time.
The great, great, great box office disasters in 2004. It has come into its own, thank you, internet.
Aged like a fine wine.
Yeah, if you were 13 years old when that movie came out, you owe me a debt of thanks. But unfortunately, at the time, you didn't buy a ticket. But anyway, so I was in the Czech Republic, and this would have been an early, actually, Profiles in History auction. They had a Darth Vader helmet where it was a stunt helmet from The Empire Strikes Back. And what I mean by a stunt helmet was it had these sort of two almost triangles cut out under the eyes. Because if you think about the Darth Vader helmet head, it's much bigger than an actual human being's head. And for the stunt guy to fight with a lightsaber and move his feet up and down, especially in those Bespin, the darkness of the Bespin steps where they're fighting in the carbon chamber pit, like he needed to be able to look down. The stuntman needed to be able to look and see his feet.
Well, and the stuntman was almost certainly smaller.
And
than
he was smaller.
David Prowse, the giant bodybuilder exactly, that they put in the costume, right?
Yeah. And so they cut these triangles out and they put this like smoky glass there, smoky plastic, so he could see out, but on the camera you couldn't really tell that those triangles were there. So it was a screen used stunt helmet, Empire Strikes Back.
And we would call this a great tell, because that's the kind of thing, if you're making a fake Darth Vader helmet,
no one makes a fake stunt. Yes. No one cuts out the those things in an
perspex panels into the, yes.
So it was gorgeous. It was wonderful. What can I say? It was what it was. And I decided I must have this thing. And I did everything we've talked about today. I did my research. I went and I don't believe I got to see it because I was in Prague, but I saw a million photos of it. And I think sent a friend of mine to the auction house with a camera to take a million pictures on top of the pictures that the auction house sent me. I arranged phone bidding, which for me in Prague, I believe was like the middle of the night also. So, you know, again, the full works, I set my price. You know, I was basically ready for this thing, and I'm going to go for this thing. And I'm on the phone, and I'm bidding. And it's sort of the same thing. Very quickly, it's just like bam, 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 bam. No matter what I bid, it keeps going. And now I'm doing this thing, which I don't highly recommend, which is I'm blowing past the number that I was willing to spend, and I literally am just making a list in my head of things in my collection at that point that I would sell. And it wasn't just props. I was actually selling. In my mind, I was like, well, this guy likes this piece of comic art. I can sell that for $20,000. This guy likes this. I can sell that for $10,000. And I'm just adding up it. And as I'm doing the math, I just keep bidding. And I'm bidding and I'm bidding and I'm bidding. And they're not stopping. So at some point, it definitely registered to me that like they're not stopping. And so numbers that like at the time were baffling, although unfortunately they've become more commonplace, as we were zooming towards, you know, basically over 100,000, I just started to think to myself, well, maybe that's his high. You know what I mean? Maybe that's his breaking point. If I can just get it over that number, if he keeps going, it's going to, you know, that was basically how I was trying to think about it. These were my strategies, such as it was. And again, I broke every one of my own rules. It was just an absolute just shit show on my part.
Were you married yet at this point?
No, of course not.
Oh, okay, good. I was going to say,
yeah, no,
did
not
your
even,
wife have
not
any
even
idea
possible,
that this was going
not
on?
Not even okay. possible. Yeah, she knew what was going on because I think she was actually visiting me in Prague and I was like, excuse me, I got to go make a phone call.
She's like, you just bought 3 golf balls. What else could you need?
No, this will be better. This is like golf balls 5 through 10. And it just keeps going. And I stopped. I mean, there was nothing else I could do. I stopped. And basically the winner of the piece, and it was in his collection for many years, often on display, often in his museum, was Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft. And when I think back on it, what I especially love, besides, again, like breaking all my own rules, was I worked myself up into a frothy sweat. I mean, I was making deals with myself. Like, I'm going to take jobs. I'm going to rewrite scripts I don't want to rewrite. And I'm guessing Paul Allen didn't even know the auction was happening. He just told some guy, go win that thing.
There was an intern.
Yeah, exactly. An unpaid intern who didn't think, was just eating a bagel, didn't think twice about just.
Or he wrote a bot.
Right. Wiping the floor with me. And so like by the time I'm done, there's just like a pool of sweat on the floor of my Prague hotel room. I'm like crying. I've lost. And meanwhile, Paul Allen is on his yacht somewhere. May he rest in peace. And there was nothing that could happen. But I will say, and it's a sort of a funny story, because of the number that helmet got, this often happens, a second helmet showed itself, and a helmet that George Lucas had put into a DGA charity auction almost like 10 years before, reemerged because of the number on this prop. So now another Darth Vader helmet, not identified. It had been placed in a case. It had been repainted. It was a little harder to zero in on, but it had a letter from the head of the archives at the time, Don Bees. And the story then keeps going, which is then, you know, years and years later, as there was more information about these Vader helmets, what I was able to do is I was actually able to identify the helmet that I bought as probably a tour suit, something that was made for touring, but used in the archives. And they grabbed everything. So again, one of these pieces where you can't say it wasn't used on screen, but, you know, no way of really knowing, unfortunately. And I ultimately actually sold that piece off when I was able to find an actual screen-matched helmet from Empire. So at the end of the day, although for a lot more money, I did finally end up with an Empire Vader helmet. Fuck you, Paul Allen. But burn in hell, Paul
Allen.
Rest in
peace.
Rest in peace, exactly. But a very long, almost, you know, like 15-year odyssey of helmets, of, you know, buying, selling, and upgrading. So kind of a crazy story. But again, I will not forget that condition I was in that night at 3 a.m. in Prague, of just a wreck of a man, just a true wreck. And I do think
auction flop sweat.
Yeah. Look, there is an adrenaline to these auctions. There's no way of saying it. And you do have to watch out for that adrenaline, because it is, as much as there's an adrenaline to prop collecting in general, I think when you kind of get that thing you want, that moment of bidding fever of like, yes, bid, I'll beat him, bid, bid more, bid higher, yes, keep bidding. It's incredible and very, very dangerous. All righty, so this is the time where we like to play our little game where we mention a movie and try and sort of pick the prop we'd most want from it. We've got Joe Maddalena back from Profiles in History. Joe, we sort of were thinking in anticipation of your being a guest, we were trying to think of kind of a more kind of classic Hollywood movie. And so if you could have any prop in the world in your own collection, the today's movie is Casablanca. What are you going to take from Casablanca? It's a tough one. I definitely have a couple of ideas, but it's a tough one.
Dooley Wilson's piano.
The piano is pretty recognizable. I feel like it is one of those, we always talk about the mom test where your mom can look at it and go, oh, that's the piano from Casablanca.
Well, to me, it's more what it represents. I mean, that's like to see Dooley Wilson playing the piano. It's like, I don't know. The moment would be like, you know, the piano would be hard to beat.
Yeah. Well, that was our wedding song. So, yeah, I mean, that's a great piece.
No, it's that the singing, the iconic, don't play that song. I mean, it ties all of that up together.
Play it again, Sam.
Yeah. You played it for me, you know, the whole thing. Ryan, can you make a better case for anything?
I mean, for me, it's like, you know, that's the golden age of wardrobe. And you know, all the wardrobe was so beautifully, you know, made back in that period. Nothing was bought off the rack. Everything was, you know, was hand cut and hand designed for the actor. It's got to be Bogey's trench coat. I mean, I think that actually exists above and beyond. As great as Casablanca is, I am a huge Humphrey Bogart fan, and I've watched. I mean, he's got a million movies, but I've watched like, you know, 30% of his 1,000 movies. And I love him. I think he's the prototypical anti-hero movie star. And that trench coat from that movie, you can just see that.
Bogey in the trench coat is very, I mean, it's, you know, it's the Harrison, the indie leather jacket or whatever you want.
Right.
It's very,
the Blade Runner coat. Yeah, exactly.
Look, the piano was very much on my list. So funny, as was the trench coat. I was trying to think of like, props, and the best I could come up with, although I admit I don't even know what they look like, was the letters of transit, only in the sense that they sort of are, in a way, sort of almost like the MacGuffin of the movie. You know what I mean? Like that.
Are you talking about the passports?
Not the passports, but the signed,
the fabled
French.
Yeah.
You don't even really get a good look at them, but basically it's what Ungari asks him to. They kill the couriers and then he hides them in the piano, and you don't really ever get to see them. But just the fact that all of the machinations of the movie are about those letters of transit that will allow you to get on the plane, you know, to Lisbon and then back to the United States. I guess what they represent in terms of just the whole movie turning on it. But I'm still going to actually defer to piano, I got to say.
Well, that was great. Great answers, everybody. Thank you for playing, Joe. Thank you for joining us today.
Please, though, if you have questions, as always, or comments, please email us at dreamsaremadeofpodcast@gmail.com. And also, you can follow us where, Ryan?
On Instagram at Props Podcast, and also on Twitter, also at Props Podcast, which is the stuff dreams are made of. Please subscribe on whatever your favorite podcast app is. Give us 5 stars. Give us a good review. Tell a friend. Tell 3 friends. And to continue on with this topic, later this season, we're actually going to do part 2. Even though this feels like a 4-part episode at this point, we are going to do part 2 of our auction series. And what we're going to do is we're going to preview a live auction about a couple weeks before it happens. Where
Ryan and I are going to get the catalog and basically
early.
Look at it. We're going to get it early, but we are going to look at it for the first time as we record and basically take you through how we look at an auction catalog for the first time and begin to start sort of thinking about stuff. And hopefully that'll be really fun. So again, subscribe. We'll see you then.
This is The Stuff Dreams Are Made Of, and we will see you next week.